Merci à tous d'être revenus dans cette salle. On va commencer cet après-midi avec une série de trois communications. Céline Murillo, Sébastien Farge, Thémus Sureya Gurbus. Et disons que la thématique générale de l'après-midi, c'est un lien plus ou moins étroit avec la production cinématographique, donc les liens entre punk et cinéma. On va voyager pas mal du côté de New York, finalement. Hein. Pas que, mais pas mal. Mais avec des éclairages aussi sur des personnalités françaises. Donc il y a vraiment un lien, et on est vraiment au cœur de la thématique, hein, de la circulation des acteurs. Et regardez un petit peu comment tout ça se connecte. Voilà, donc, so let's start,
thank you very much. Mike Dines couldn't be here today, so I just said that, like, learning that we don't have a moderator, looks like I'll do it. So our panel, it seems to be mostly on filmmaking, cinema, and audiovisual media. And our first speaker is Céline Murillo from Paris 13. The University of Paris 13, and she's going to present on No Wave Cinema as Mirror of the Lower East Side Decay.
Thank you, Thémus. So I am very happy to talk again, in fact, about No Wave Films in the frame of the Punk Scarlet Network. I was first invited by Thémus, and then I came several times. Anyway. So today my talk presents the current result of an ongoing research on No Wave Cinema. And the films that I've been working on were made in New York in 1976. It's a self-proclaimed birth date of No Wave Cinema by filmmaker Amos Poe when he released The Blank Generation. And it finishes in 1984. It's the moment with when Jean-Michel Basquiat sold a painting to Mary Boone for $20,000 and thus entered the art market. So in this research project, I limit myself to films that are narrative and figurative with a low budget, and made by members of the No Wave scene. It sounds like a circular art. Argument, I know, but it is important to say that it is because it's so interconnected as a scene that people identify themselves as No Wave, they recognize themselves as No Wave, that it creates such a vibrant, energizing, and creative environment. So the scenesters were teenager and young adults, and they were a mixture of people who either came from abroad, from Europe, for example, like Vivian Dick or Eric Mitchell or Lizzie Mercier-Desclous. And they also came from other regions of the U.S. Most of them fled conservative, patriarchal circumstances. They flocked the Lower East Side. They flocked all in the Lower East Side, and this place was suffering, this zone of Manhattan, suffered from deindustrialization and also from an anti-urban sentiment that led... There is a lot of... So they flocked... There was a lot of anti-urban sentiment, and so most of the middle class, either white or Puerto Rican, tended to go away. It was more than white flight. It was general middle class flight. It was affected by something called planned shrinkage, meaning that the city, who had no money, was nearly bankrupt, concentrated its efforts on the zone that were most wealthy, and they completely let down the Lower East Side. So there was no policing, no road service, no tenement repairs. The rents, as a result, were very cheap. And in addition, the drugs were also very cheap from reasons that are more linked to geopolitical phenomenon. So the place was quite dangerous. P- Police reports say that there was a surge in crime, especially mugging and robbery. In Vivian de Kleist's film that is called New York, Our Time, it's released very recently, Pat Play says that it was common to be mugged, because but that there were few shootings, I would say, because everybody was so slow because of drugs. So the artists and filmmakers on the No Wave scene were aware of this contradiction, and they were taking advantage of it. They rented cheap places where they could practice their art and have fun. So I decided to do this talk because of this contradiction, because it was a little bit annoying to hear people saying it again and again. Oh, it was so dangerous. Oh, it was so marvelous. Oh, it was hell. It was a wasteland and it was a playground. So I wanted to go further than the repetition. I wanted to look at what it meant in terms of representation in the films. For example, I wanted to know if the characters were robbers or muggers or killers or victims or artists, and how this played out in the end. So I have this very dialectic outline, sort of apologize for the dryness of it, but I will start with the wasteland versus playground, the oscillation, like I just explained. So I'll begin with a quote about the Mud Club. The Mud Club had been created by Steve Mas. It was a venue for both No Wave bands and No Wave films. And Richard Block, a former doorman for this venue, wrote in his memoir, "I've always referred to the Mud Club as the scene of crime. It was the night that never ended, the day before never happened, and the day after, a long way off, was a long way off. There was nothing else like it." The sentence through the word crime links the excitement of the present of the night scene, the night that never ended, with the violence of the surrounding and the deviousness of what was happening inside the Mud Club. So it shows how Lower Manhattan, by being a wasteland, was also a playground where everything was possible, if not allowed, stricto sensu. So at the Mud Clubs, no rules applied, provided that you donned a creative outfit and you could get in. So when you were in, it was an anything-goes environment for indulging drug, dancing, seeing new art, and listening to live music. So another person who does a similar analysis is Marie Paul. She is, I think she's still alive, a fashion influencer who became famous for her knack at taking Polaroid pictures and spotting trends. So she also uses a play on word to describe downtown New York in the 1970s. So somebody asks her, how would you describe the 80s New York City era that you capture with your Polaroid in three words? No man's land. The streets belong to everybody. Roaming the streets of New York then was our pastime. We were biking and walking instead of taking the subway. It belonged to everybody. Places like LA, New York, Paris, Madrid is such a mix of everything, of everybody from over the world. A no man's land, I'm telling you. We were the new wave in a land that we made ours, that belonged to us. So the phrase no man's land normally refers to interstitial spaces between borders, especially when there is a tension, a military conflict. It can also be called DMZ, demilitarized zone. And this notion is very often used when we talk about the Lower East Side, when there are changing borders between the place where the Latino were living and the whites were living. Both phrases, no man's land and DMZ, implies that the place remains uninhabited and no law per se applies. It suggests a dangerous place. But instead of focusing on this, focusing on the absence of protection, on the danger, Marie-Paul rather welcomes the absence of coercion, the absence of ownership. It is as if the place was up for grabs. It's a place where she could create her own world. So to put it very simply, for Marie-Paul, the depression, the white flight, and other economic phenomena had scared away the rich, the middle class, the family-minded people, and left the space empty for working artists who live a bohemian type of life, and what Richard Florida calls the creative class. So they use this place so they can produce art that is not fettered by the bourgeois system. So this is shown very clearly in a movie that was produced by Marie-Paul herself. And it was shot in and directed by Edo Bertolio. It was shot in 1981, as its title says, but it was released much later. In Downtown 81, the hyperbolic variation between the positive and negative polarities of the Lower East Side and New York in general appear in Jean-Michel Basquiat voiceover. So, and it's Jean-Michel Basquiat voiceover, sorry, by a slam artist called Saul Williams. So the dialogue, in fact, the original dialogue had been lost in post-production, and this is why they've added this voiceover. So I'm going to play this. It's going to be more effective.
We dropped the bomb on ourselves, but it was okay. I'd met a beautiful woman, and she'd put me up for a night or two. I found enough money in my apartment to buy a joint. All I had to do was sell this painting for $500. Why not? You can get anything you want here if you try. And you can get plenty of what you don't want, too. If you're not careful.
Hey, brother, I got Dr. Nova. I got BT-82. Uh-huh. One bag and fuck you up, bro.
I'm sure. All right.
What do you want? I got the green, I got coke, I got gimmicks. Tell me what you need.
A good question, but none of his business.
Dynamite, man.
If you want to see something ugly, you never have too far to go. But if you want to find something beautiful, well, that's not too hard either. In this town, anything is possible. Around here, you have to think big just to survive. It can be a jungle, and it can be a paradise, too. And sometimes, you can't tell the difference.
Boom.
Hey, my man.
How you doing?
Okay. In the clip, the binary oppositions pile up. Beauty, ugliness, what you want, what you don't want, love, hate, heaven, hell. And in the initial statement, what is negative is the effective, greedy, deteriorated New York with the bomb, etc. And what is positive is what is less material. Here is the hope that he derived from meeting a top model. But later in the film, it can be the happiness he gets from meeting Marie-Paul at a fashion show. So the film oscillates between a down-and-out Basquiat, whose music equipment gets stolen, whose check cannot be cashed in, and his luck. His luck meeting a patron, wealthy patron, is luck finding a solution to attend a sold-out concert. And the film ends on a massive stroke of luck or a magic moment. So after... After a homeless woman demands a kiss, she's transformed into a princess, Debbie Harry, by the way, who grants his every wish. And then he finds a suitcase full of cash and buys a car. When the day starts, and I think I'm going to play that maybe just for the pleasure of listening to the music. And so when the day starts, you will hear what happens.
I drove through the night and into the day, like I was driving to the end of a dream. And when I saw the light, I knew I was awake. And it was good.
Sorry. So when the day starts, Basquiat is still in the car, meaning that at least the car is not a dream. So in this film, the dreams are leading to or conducive to a better form of reality. And in the end, there is some union, some fusion between the reality and the dream, between the wasteland and the playground. So I'm going to move on to my second example, Permanent Vacation by Jim Jarmusch, which further and differently blurs the difference between dream and reality. So instead of living the psyche of the character totally upbeat as it is in Downtown 81, Jean-Michel Basquiat is always happy whatever happens. Here, the urban decay's negative effect have an influence on the minds of the character. Ali, the main character, is a cool drifter. He makes a number of cool encounters, a girl, a man in a cinema, a saxophonist, John Lurie, actually, and a hip guy like himself, and he even dances to the music of Earl Bostic like a hep cat. However, there is a sense of emptiness, of vacation, of lack of goals. And so what happens is that there's going to be a confusion between sleeping states and wake. So Ali says, I can't seem to sleep at night, not in the city. And he continues, I have my dream when I'm awake. So this is going to lead to many moments of magic realism in the film, which is one of Jim Jarmusch's trademark, in fact. The traditional phrase to describe the decrepit building in the Lower East Side, the vacant lots that are like this because of abandonment, arson, and so they are said to be bombed out. And we saw that earlier in Downtown 81. So this is referring to images of city like Warsaw or Berlin after World War II. But here, the character takes it literally and staunchly believes that there was a war in New York. I don't think I have time to play that. So Ali meets different characters who are out of their mind. For example, his institutionalized mother, who may have lived World War II, asks whether there was another war when hearing planes. A Vietnam veteran confuses the overhead helicopters with planes while we actually hear the noise of bombshells. So maybe I'd like to play that a little bit, maybe not all of it though. I know, yeah. Less than
what's
that.
What's the matter? Hey, I thought there was a plane! Get on the ground!
Hey, take it easy, man. So not even planes, there are choppers. The Kong doesn't have choppers. Come on, man. Take it easy. Get up. You see? Those are American.
I think I'm going to jump a bit further. Again.
You want a cigarette?
Yeah.
I don't know what just wanted to...
Out of my house, where I live now. And the same car I saw, the same exact car. Wow, it really flipped, man. It lit up like a bomb, this car, you know.
So he's telling the dream that it...
Really like a Batmobile, you know.
So yes, just wanted to have you hear the bombs. So, so it feels that it feels like what happens in your mind when you are in a when you have a dream. That is, you put everything together. So here we are putting together World War II, the Vietnam War trauma, and the Lower East Side actual state of destruction. So in the film, the Lower East Side urban decay actually feels like a war for the spectator, who sees rubble, hear planes, and get to meet the war casualties and the exiles, like a Spanish girl, for example, with shouting in mad fear in the rubble. So the war metaphor is Jarmusch's way to express the violence of the conditions experience. It derives from this lack of differentiation between the dream state and the wake. So in there is not an uplifting conclusion as in Downtown 81 in this film. Here, the power of the dream and the powers of magical realism enable Ali to visualize a two-tone car, a shiny car, that in fact... So he sees it in a dream, and in the end of the film, this car materializes, and at that point, Ali is able to magically climb in the car and steal the car and get money from it and to go away to Paris. The hero is this way, this time, is a minor offender or an offender. So I wanted to go further, to see if there could be a further fusion between the character and the crime-ridden environment. So I chose Amos Poe's Subway Rider, that is a mammoth of a film, 2 hours, I think, more or less. And according to Poe, it is a representation of the violence of the city mediated by his own fantasies. So the film is half noir film, half German expressionism, and 100% no wave. It's about a sax player turned serial killer by an Oedipal complex, made even more acute because he has female neighbors, a couple of sex workers and performers, who force him to play his sax outdoors, and this way, he's faced with the violence of the city, and then he retaliates. The film showcases all the phenomena that caused anti-urban sentiment in the 1970s and led the middle classes to move to the suburbs. So the living conditions are not very good. You can hear your neighbors when at night. Your neighbors may expose you to immorality. There are drugs. The wife of the cop is the cop who's in charge of the pursuit is a drug addict. And of course, there is crime since the main character is a serial killer. So the film seems to be an entire reflection of this fear. The space is dark and uninhabitable and impossible to understand. So the way the character handles the city space is very personal and idiosyncratic. So it nearly fails to create a consistent... I don't have time to show all this. I'm finishing very quickly. The way the character handles the city is. We don't have a good sensation of a complete diegetic space. For example, to begin with, the film is based in lambent color, very vivid colors. Some of them are attached to a character like a leitmotif. And these colors are not at all realistic. So this doesn't help us to understand. One of the characters, Claire, is a seer. She materializes at will, and she can move vertically. She gives the movie a touch of magic, realism, especially the way she moves up and down a building. So the entire film seems to be deprived of logic and drenched in color and emotion, fear, aggression, love and protection, trust and paranoia. And the very messy space, the difficulty to be able to follow what is going on, the freedom of the editing, make it look like a huge playground for the very filmmaker. We get the impression that the filmmaker was like having a lot of fun making this. But as far as a representation is concerned, it's 100% negative. There is no playground for the characters. So I'm going to conclude. The opposition between playground and wasteland leads to various moods in the films. The playground is dominant in Downtown 81, maybe because Basquiat, as a street artist... Basquiat, as a street artist, could make an action on the city. And so he could transform by his graffiti... It could transform the wasteland into a playground. For Ali, in Permanent Vacation, the gritty real and the dream unite when he steals the car. And in the mood is even darker in Subway Riders, because there is no play left in the representation. And the main character cannot, is forbidden to have an intervention in the city. So my hypothesis, my conclusion is that the least people can have an intervention on the city, the least the city is a playground for the character and artist, the more it becomes a wasteland. So this is in keeping with this quotation that I hope you can read by Jane Jacobs, and according to which is the dance of the pedestrian, the activity in the city that makes it safe and livable. Thank you very much.